classic.
Think about it. It's like an 80-year lifespan.
Be sure and tell her one.
Every 50 one out of 25 or
something. That's crazy. That's not die from this or that. It's murder.
I'm back.
Nice, man.
Wow.
Love it. That's a gavel.
I'm opening. Welcome. Yeah. Welcome to all the crowds out there. And welcome
TVs,
to the committee.
On the TVs.
I was told on the way down here to use a really good gavel the first time. And so I took that to heart, obviously.
Cherry bombs.
I would like to welcome you to the Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee. It's my first opportunity to chair a committee. But I'm really excited about that. I'm very honored to have that. Be in that position. I want to make just a couple of comments, and we'll ask the committee members to introduce yourselves, maybe give a little overview of why you think you're here and what you're interested in. Also, first off, though, I want to introduce Laura Kentness, our analyst, and she has done a fantastic job so far. And then Maya Daniel, our committee assistant, working really well as a team, too. So very super excited working with both of them. Welcome to, we have both new and returning members of this committee. So some of what we do today will be kind of a review for the experienced members and new and exciting material for the newcomers. I want to mention a couple of things for members just to kind of get some of the protocol etiquette reminders out for people. And I want to make sure that everybody has a chance to be heard. So this may be the first hearing some of you have gone through. So I just want to note that if you have questions, want to make comments, please kind of signal Laura or I. We'll be keeping a list here and try to respond to those in order. And just make sure everybody is heard. If you have continuing questions, and the general protocol is just kind of, hey, may I continue or just ask again. So, you know, if people get too excited, they might want to ramble on. So try to control that. Also know that we're all really, really super busy. And so the temptation is to try to do some multitasking. Personal request is that when you're here, please be here. And to me, that means minimum amount of texting, emails, and so forth that don't apply to the work in this committee. And people in the audience, for future reference, they really do use their computers for committee-related work up here. So the fact they're using one isn't a bad sign. So I will try to start meetings on time, and I really wanted to note the excellent behavior. Everybody got here on time today, and we got started. So that's a great start, but I think it's just respectful of everybody else's time. And anything I forgot or any questions along those lines? Okay, very good. Just one personal philosophy. I do value every member's input, your thoughts. I think a very collaborative type of person. I think I've talked to everybody except for Rep. Clem about the committee and what we're trying to do. And so I just know that my door is always open. If you have issues, problems, suggestions, anything, just please come up and let's work together on it. We're here just to create good policy, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, you should have received a spreadsheet from Laura with all the bills on those. Hopefully that's helpful. And just kind of rough groupings, we've got about 5 related to community colleges, 4 for HEC. 3 related to the role of HEC that I don't think they submitted, a few related to veterans and how they're served, a couple of them regarding data and reporting, a couple on student loans, and so far only 3 workforce development bills, but you're going to have some hearings on the bills, and maybe that will inspire us to do additional work groups or maybe bills in the future. Okay, I should take a breath. Okay, today's panel is we'll provide an overview of HEC. Are you pointing at this? Am I forgetting something? I am. Thank you. Yep. All right, that's why she's here. got excited about hearing Ben, and I'd like to take an opportunity just to ask you guys to introduce yourself, and I guess Werner, since you're, Reschke, since you're the newest and on the end, why don't you go ahead and kick it off.
Thank you. My name is Werner Reschke. I represent House District number 56, which is Southern Klamath and Southern Lake Counties. In my district, there is Oregon Tech, or OIT as it's also known as, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Klamath Community College. So this committee is very important to not only myself, but also my district.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Janelle Bynum. I represent House District 51, East Portland, North Clackamas, Happy Valley, Damascus, Gresham, and Boring. And I am an employer and greatly, deeply committed to making sure that our students are prepared for jobs of the future.
Mark Johnson from House District 52. I was able to say this in the previous session, and it still is true as we enter this session, that I am the longest serving member of House Higher Ed. My fourth session here, and I'm proud to be a part of, I think, a good body of work that this legislature has accomplished over the last 8 years, going from breaking up the Oregon University system, or let's just say redeploying it. As we have, we created institutional boards for our universities. Proud to be a part of the Oregon Promise Initiative in the last session and so forth. So we've done some good work over the past 4 years, not to mention, obviously, adopting 40-40-20 as our North Star that should be informing our policy decisions and our funding priorities and so forth and so on as well. So look forward to continuing to build on that work and working with the members on the committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you have your foot in another part of the education system as well, right?
I'm also a school board member in my 12th year as a school board member in Hood River County School District, too. K-12 and higher ed.
May I be excused, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Buenas tardes. Good afternoon. My name is Teresa Alonso Leon, and I am House District Representative for, sorry, a little nervous. I represent District 22, which is Woodburn through the north part of Salem. And I am very passionate about education. I've worked as a teacher assistant back in the day and worked my way up working with nonprofit organizations and developing parent engagement programs and retention programs. And then worked for higher ed and the universities, and then just recently left my position as the GED administrator for the HEC. So I've worked in education pretty much all my life, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Gene Wisnett, state rep from House District 53. I live in Sun River. A lot of people say, what are you doing in Salem? this is my... Mark has four sessions in this committee. I have three as vice chair. Jeff, Representative Reardon, Representative Reed, and now Senator Denbrough. But I think I've served six sessions in education, either policy or ways and means. And I guess I'm your representative for the ways and means on education subcommittee this session. Look forward to... I think we've got some interesting things here to look at. I think we've done a good job. I hope that the chair and the committee members will remain dedicated to making higher education more affordable and accessible, and also hope that we can find ways to help grow the workforce. So,
thank you.
I'm Brian Clem, the one that the chair didn't want to talk to about anything related to this committee, so I'm just over here trying to figure out what's going on. My district is here in Salem. I've got Willamette University across the street in my district, and a lot of the, like, literally streets around Chebeckinah Community College, but the campus itself is in Teresa's, but every other part of the neighborhood is in mine. And so my primary interest probably comes from the 6 years that I spent as chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission under Governors Kitzhaber and Kulongoski. And my freshman year in 07, we had a higher ed, I think it was a subcommittee of the Education Committee that Peter Buckley chaired, and I served on that. And then I I was off for 8 years while all the important restructuring happened, and I groaned and complained about it from the floor, and now I'm back now that it's largely over. So as Ben knows, I do certainly have opinions and have a passion about access and affordability, like Representative Wisnett talked about, and I'm happy to be back in the higher ed world.
Good to have you.
I'm Dallas Hurd, House District 2. That's Roseburg down to just north of Grants Pass. And as far as why I think I'm here, probably more on the workforce development side, since I'm not highly educated like my esteemed colleague here. But I am
an OSU liberal arts degree is not considered a huge thing. Sorry, Jack.
But I am excited to be here. You know, back where I'm from in Douglas County, we have a lot of good jobs with high pay waiting for folks with the right skill set. And there's a lot of talented folks down there that just, for whatever reason, just weren't able to walk through the right door of opportunity to get the education they needed in the skills trades or what have you, so that they can pursue some good careers. So I'm hungry to dive into that and figure this out. And one thing before I move on, I wanted to hit on that I really appreciated the chair reaching out to me. He's the first chair I've had in my second term now that actually ever reached out to me ahead of time and, you know, welcomed me to the committee and really made me, you know, feel like that he really is concerned about my ideas, you know, coming to him and that he's going to give them a lot of consideration. So I really appreciate that about Jeff.
Thank you. I'm Janine Salmon. I represent House District 30. I am a new freshman representative, and I am really excited to be on this committee. I serve on the House District 30 is Beaverton, Alloa, Orenco, Hillsborough area, North Plains. I serve on the school board in Hillsborough. I have for 8 years now, and have been a member of the Career and College Pathways Steering Committee. So CTE vocational is definitely a strong passion of mine. I really value the fact that it really shows that there are multiple pathways for students. And I think that when we look at our CTE and we look at vocational, we're looking at opportunities that benefit our students, that benefit workforce, and benefit our economy. So I am ready to roll up the sleeves and get working on this. And I would like to echo as well, I was very pleased that the chair reached out, and we've had multiple conversations, and I thank him for that. And yeah.
Well, thank you. Well, this is a great panel. Am I looking at yours or mine? Okay. Hey, do I need to hit that or no? Don't have to pound anything yet. Huh? Okay, I'm opening an organizational hearing for the purpose of adopting committee rules. And committee rules are just what you're going to see in any other committee, so we did not get creative about it. If you really want to read those, they are posted and available on OLIS. And I'd like to ask the Vice Chair, Alonso Leon, to read a motion, if you would be so kind.
Thank you, Chair Reardon. Chair Reardon, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2017.
Rep. Alonso Leon moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2017. Any discussion? Okay. There was no discussion. Any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. All right. I am closing the organizational hearing for the purpose of adopting committee rules. Okay, I'm opening a work session for the possible introduction of committee bills. And to the members, especially the new ones, it is a common practice to introduce committee measures, and there's often broad support for their introduction. But even if you don't agree with the merits of the bill today, just as a matter of procedure and courtesy, we do allow the bills to be introduced as committee measures. You're voting yes or no on these measures is no indication that you support them or not. You would not have to necessarily vote for them in the future. We do want to introduce those. So we may have a...
Chair Reardon, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3947, dated February the 1st, 2017. LC 3950, dated January 25th, 2017. LC 3952, dated January 25th, 2017.
Okay. Rep. Wisnett moves that LC 3947, dated 2/1/2017, and LC 3950, dated 1/25/2017, and LC 3952, dated 1/25/2017, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? I'm going to ask our committee analyst, Laura Kentness, to briefly describe those bills and then ask if there's any discussion.
Chair, members of the committee, LCs 3947, 3950, and 3952 are all bills related to youth employment. They're put in at the request of the chair. The LCs are sourced from an interim work group related to workforce development and youth initiatives.
Okay. Yeah. Any discussion? Okay. Excellent. Hearing no objections, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Okay. We're getting it done. Okay, I'm opening an informational hearing on higher education in Oregon. The goals, structure, funding, I think, like I said earlier, it's a good review for some of us and a great introduction to others. We will have many of the things that we do in here are related to the to HEC. And so I'm pleased to introduce Ben Cannon, the executive director and former state legislator.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, executive director of the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Very pleased to be here and appreciate the chair's invitation to present today some introductory thoughts about higher education in Oregon. Also appreciate the fact of this committee existing to dedicate some time and attention to higher education issues. There's a lot that has occurred within the last few years at the sort of state level with respect to higher ed. And if nothing else, this committee should be a great venue to provide some updates on that work and for you to provide some input, feedback, and potential new direction as we take the next steps in improving higher education and workforce in Oregon. I really look forward to working with the committee and all of you as individual members. When the HEC was created back in 2011 initially and then more robustly in 2013, part of the purpose was to provide support and advice, resources, and information to policymakers, including, most importantly, legislators. And so that is a significant part of our role and purpose, and to do so with an impartial and broad view of higher education. So please do call on me, call on my staff to support you in your attempts to move higher education and workforce forward. One more note before I begin. Our name, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, or the HEC, clearly indicates our interest in responsibilities for higher ed. But I also want to note that our agency is significantly involved in workforce development activities that don't even necessarily include higher education institutions. We work closely with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and the Oregon Employment Department with our local workforce boards in that portfolio. We also have activities focused on the GED or high school equivalency program, as Representative Alonzo Leon well knows, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, a sort of host of activities that don't quite fit that HEC higher ed umbrella, but are very important and may be topics of interest to this committee. Today's presentation, at the request of the chair, really will be focused on the higher education portfolio primarily, and I'll cover kind of three or four major areas, focusing, as the chair indicated, around our state goals and progress towards them, the structure for higher education in Oregon, and then a closer look at issues of affordability and student success and state funding. And I think my preference, at the pleasure of the chair, would be to take your questions whenever and whenever. I'm happy to be interrupted. I have, I think, about 30 slides, some of which, you know, will go quick. Others we can spend more time on, but really look to you for the feedback and direction and questions as we go. I'll move off this slide. Progress towards state goals. So wanted to begin, but just by reminding the commission, I think this is not new to anyone, including even new members to the legislature, but Oregon adopted in 2011 an ambitious goal for education in Oregon, really a statement of intent around the state of Oregon and our future, with a particular view towards the type of economy and society that we hope eventually to have. And it's one where, under law, 40% of adult Oregonians would hold a bachelor's degree or advanced degree. Another 40% would have an associate's degree or meaningful post-secondary certificate. That could be a one-year certificate. It could be even shorter term than that. And all adult Oregonians hold a high school diploma. Very often we are asked, how is Oregon doing towards that goal? So that's what this slide attempts to depict. The right-hand bar is the goal. So the bachelor's and advanced degrees are the blue bar. That's the 40% goal. The yellow 40% is our middle 40, associate's degree or certificate, and the 20% are students who, under the goal, would have completed high school but not have earned a post-secondary degree or credential. The left-hand bar is the or column is our current best estimate of progress towards that goal. This is focused on the adult population. So as Oregonians are surveyed by the Census Bureau, updated annually through the American Community Service, they survey, they report their highest level of educational attainment. And we believe that it works out to something like 33% of Oregonians with a bachelor's or advanced degree, compared with the 40% goal. Another 17% with a middle 40 credential, that associates or some sort of certificate. And the rest, broken down between that sort of students who have completed high school and taken some college, that's the 18%, some college but not a degree or certificate, another 22% who have completed high school or its equivalent, and then the 10% who have not completed high school. That 10%, if you just look at that for a moment, you may be thinking, well, our high school graduation rate's closer to 70%. Why is that only 10%? And in part, that's only 10% because many students who are not counted for the purposes of our high school graduation rates do earn high school equivalency either through GED or other means, and they eventually find themselves in that high school diploma, that red or blue or yellow, red or brown or yellow or blue bars. So that's our best guess of current progress towards the 40-40-20 goal for the 25 to 64-year-old population.
And just clarification, this is the entire population post-high school from 19 to 90.
Correct, Mr. Chair. And in a moment, in a couple of slides, we're going to sort of focus on young Oregonians in particular. But the goal, the 40-40-20 goal, is in statute. It is a goal for all adult Oregonians. And so what we attempt to depict here is our sort of best guess of our best estimate of our progress against the statutory goal. To be clear, the statute actually says all adult Oregonians. This is a somewhat selective view. It's adults 25 to 64, so we've sort of set aside the maybe retirement age population, but this is our view of really the working age population.
Thank you. Vice Chair, wasn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, how would you evaluate what we, this body and your body and the university's, 2011 to this is 2015, how are we doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, there are some subsequent slides that speak to the progress, the increasing numbers of degrees and certificates that Oregonians are earning. That increase has been steep since 2011. To be clear, a significant part of the reason for that was the recession that drove many Oregonians to college. In order to make them, qualify themselves for a work or better work. But the fact remains that Oregon has made significant strides since 2011 on this measure. They show up on this measure as very incremental ones because this adult population goal, this is most Oregonians, 25 to 64, at least a very large chunk. And so to make progress against this takes time and it comes slowly. So even with rapid, significant increases in the number of Oregonians earning degrees and credentials, we've seen very modest increases on this particular measure. We are inching up, however. In addition to the many Oregonians who are earning, many more Oregonians who are earning degrees and certificates from our institutions, we are also benefiting from the immigration of well-educated people into Oregon. Uh-huh. And we happen to be a state that benefits from gaining more people with certificates and degrees than we lose. And so part of the incremental gain that we've made, particularly in the blue, the upper 40 here, is the result of net migration that benefits Oregon from an educational standpoint.
Mr. Chair,
I would
just comment that I think things I've read of other universities trying to get higher achievement like this too is that 18% of the ones with some college is considered the low-hanging fruit that I think we should continue to work on.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Rep. Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just piggyback on Rep. Wisnett's concept. I think this is the first time I've seen that brown bar in your little presentation, which I think is helpful. But in your presentation to us, you're going to talk about strategies to move that to either yellow or blue, because that ultimately would be the objective, right?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reardon, yes, I'll touch on some. And as you know very well, there is a lot of work underway at the mm-hmm. institutional level, as well as some at the state, to bring more of that population into the completion category. And it is, for our commission, the leading sort of strategy for improving Oregon's progress towards 40-40-20.
Thank you.
The next slide, members, takes the same data and plots it for different racial ethnic categories. So here you begin to see that this bigger picture story that I just described looks differently when we start to examine it in using different lenses, whether you apply a sort of first-generation college-going lens, a income lens, or a geographic lens. There are significant disparities within Oregon related to degree attainment. So I won't go into any additional detail about this slide. There's a lot of information here, but we do think it's important. Our commission certainly believes it's important to identify these disparities and develop strategies that address them directly. And we'll speak to that in some of the upcoming slides. Now, the chair asked the question about to whom that 40-40-20 slide applied, and what I've described to you so far applies to the entire adult or the adult working age population, age 25 to 64. Under statute today, the 40-40-20 goal, taken literally, would apply to the entire adult population, including retirement age, including college age. And it would imply that a massive adult education effort is needed to reach hundreds of thousands of Oregonians who may not have earned even a high school degree or a diploma or its equivalent. And partly as a result of that sort of confusion, the HEC and the governor, via the governor, is introducing a bill this session that will propose clarifying that 40-40-20 is intended primarily as 40-40-20 to apply to students coming up through Oregon, students rising through our K-12 system, but that equally ambitious goals need also to be set for our entire adult age population. So House Bill 2311 proposes that the commission establish by rule and in conjunction with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, appropriate attainment goals for the adult Oregon population, which may or may not be 40-40-20, depending on the type of economy that we envision having, the type of job opportunities that we foresee. And we believe that would be a more effective way of driving state policy, funding decisions, budgets on the part of the commission and the legislature. That is a conversation I expect will occur in this committee, okay, and we look forward to having it in more detail.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive my ignorance. I'm going to ask a lot of dumb questions, but I don't know. That's why I ask. What you brought up budgets and where the money's going to be spent, priorities, and so on and so forth. What determines the 40-40-20 ratio?
Representative,
how do you come up with that?
Representative Hurd, Chair Reardon. So the goals themselves, the 40-40-20 goal, is in statute. That was not something that we came up with. It's something, I think as Representative Clem alluded, that the legislature adopted in 2011 as the result of a several-year process to try to consider what sort of appropriate and ambitious goals for the state were. We then take that goal as a commission and put it at the top of our strategic plan and say, okay, that's the goal. What policies, strategies, budgets, funding allocations will be necessary in order to reach it? So that's the sort of role that it plays in our work.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. So I guess can you enlighten me further on, I guess in essence is the foundation from where you make the decisions on creating those budgets and whatnot. Does that 40-40-20 goal, does that impact how much money gets spent for K through 12 education and maybe for skilled trades versus more heavily spent on community college, four-year college, what have you?
Representative Hurd, Chair Reardon. So I guess the answer to that is it's a little in the eye of the beholder. So the intent, I believe, of 40-40-20 is that it would guide the governor, the boards and commission, and legislators in their decisions about the allocation or the appropriation of funding between K-12, higher ed, workforce investments, specific CTE or skill investments. And speaking as a member of the sort of education executive team for the executive branch, we certainly attempt to take the 40-40-20 goal into account as we make those types of recommendations. I imagine there are a variety of perspectives, and certainly 40-40-20 says nothing directly to us about how to do it, right? So there's a lot of interpretation involved in putting this goal into practice.
Thank you.
Probably a better offline question, but I think kind of a follow-up to Rep. Hurd's is when you look at the makeup of the board or the commission, does it reflect the goals in any way? In other words, is there representatives, people that would represent work in education that might advocate for one of these particular three goal areas?
Representative Reardon, members of the committee, so the commission itself that I work for, the HEC, is a 14-member commission, nine of whom are voting members. The other five are students, faculty, and staff from our institutions. The nine voting members are selected and appointed. All the members are appointed by the governor. The nine voting members are Senate confirmed. And they represent, I would say, broadly a variety of interests and perspectives in Oregon. There's geographical diversity. There's a diversity of affiliation with different sectors of higher education, two-year, four-year, public, yeah, private. And there are members who have no affiliation with higher education directly, but are civic leaders or employment leaders. And so I think it does balance the interests in sort of very high-skilled, highly educated Oregonians with those who have more career or technical-oriented training and skills, and brings all of those perspectives
forward. Okay, great. Thank you. It's very helpful.
So having drawn your attention in the last slide to the question of how are we doing on 40-40-20 for young Oregonians, where I think much of the public focus, even in connection with 40-40-20, gets placed, this is a different view of our progress. So now we're focused on students who were expected graduates of an Oregon high school in the year 2006. Okay, so these are students who, let's say they were 18 10 years ago, so they may be 28. Unfortunately, the data here is a few years old, and this is data that is actually quite challenging for us to get our hands on until we have a longitudinal data system in place that the state is working on through the Chief Education Office. But in 2013, working with partners from K-12 as well as from Echo Northwest, this analysis of those young Oregonians was done, and it showed that 7 years after their expected high school graduation date, 22% of those nearly 50,000 students, young Oregon students, young Oregonians. 22% had earned a bachelor's degree somewhere in the United States. As this wasn't just restricted to Oregon. Another 6% had earned an associate's degree or certificate. And now we see some pretty big gaps here. 28% who had started college, maybe done a couple of terms or a few credits, but not earned a certificate or degree. 35% who had completed high school or its equivalency, but not gone on, and 9% with less than the high school had not completed high school. So that's the sort of narrower view of young Oregonians, not the entire adult population, but the focus on young Oregonians rising through our system. We hope, as I mentioned, as a longitudinal data system is developed for the state of Oregon, to be able to report on this more accurately and with more frequent updates. This is the same data, a familiar chart to some of you, but not all. It's actually the same data from this slide, but described in a much more sort of visually sort of compelling or confusing, depending on your perspective, way. And it shows the same, I said 50,000, it's actually 41,000, the same set, those 41,000 students who were high school sophomores in 2004, and their patterns of high school and college enrollment and completion over the next 7 years, or I suppose 10 years. So 76% of them completed high school in a conventional setting, and then the green are students who enrolled in a four-year program, again, not limited to Oregon universities or public universities, but four-year program. Orange enrolled in a two-year program. Brown were graduated high school but didn't go further. And then the gray are students who took alternative pathways, including some who entered into a GED or high school equivalency program. There's a lot to talk about in this slide, and I'll spare you. It's a pretty fascinating depiction. We often note, though, at the commission, the sort of swirling that occurs, the back and forth between the green and the orange. That's a significant focus of our commission, to try to smooth the pathways between our institutions, between, for example, two-year and four-year institutions. Their degree outcomes are on the far right-hand side. So that's where the 22% with the four-year degree, the 6%, this is on the last slide, 6% with the two-year degree or certificate, and then the rest you see as they've fallen out. One takeaway, and this is, I wish we didn't have to report this, but the educational attainment of recent high school graduates, the higher ed educational attainment, is lower than for our adult population as a whole. Okay? So our young people by age 26, 25 is roughly when this snapshot would have been, 27 would have been by roughly that age, are less well educated in terms of certificates and degrees than the Oregon adult population as a whole, the age 25 to 64 year old population. This is consistent with the national story on this as well, where despite significant increases in recent increases in the numbers of certificates and degrees, our younger students are not earning degrees at the same rate as their older, the next older generation. And so there is a gap.
Rep. Solomon.
Thank you, Chair. I was kind of curious, are we going to have some information in regards to how many credits, how many, that students are going into these programs with? Like when you're talking about dual credit options and you're talking about opportunities where students come into a degree with a foundation already, and, how that could kind of...
Representative Silman, Chair Reardon, it's a great question and a topic that our commission and the Chief Education Office, in response in part to legislative initiatives, has been very focused on. We do have some of that data. I don't have it in this presentation. We would be happy to share what we have and talk about how to get more, potentially, both of that activity as well as data that reflects that activity.
Mm-hmm. follow up. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say, because the slide, for the class of 2006, that one, you know, when you start to look at that kind of data and you look at in those pathways, I just think that kind of tells a story of how students can come if they know they already have that foundation. When you're looking at the debt load, I think it tells a story. So I would love to have that information. And
Chair Reardon. Thank you, Chair Reardon. Ben, if you can go to the next slide, please. So it looks like majority of the students are going into our two-year degree institutions, 35%. And not a lot of them are finishing. Have we done any studies around why students aren't finishing in our two-year institutions?
So, Representative Alonzo Leon, Chair Reardon. So, just a couple of things to note. One is that a significant number of those students who enroll in a two-year program do transition to a four-year program, and they may have earned this. This particular chart doesn't tell you whether they earned a one-year certificate or a two-year degree before they did, but two-year schools are community colleges, are feeders for a significant feeders for our four-year institutions. That said, it is the case that our community college completion rates are not as high as they should be, not as high as community colleges would like them to be. There are a host of reasons for that, including, as colleges will be quick to point out, that they serve students whose goal it is not to get a certificate or degree. In some cases, it is to take a particular course for the purpose of a particular job, and they show up in this orange, but they leave before having earned the certificate and degree because they got the job. There are a variety of initiatives underway, some of them state-sponsored, many at the community college level, to improve and enhance on these completion rates at community colleges. I have a slide later on that actually gets to the completion rate question, and we'd be happy to share more about that work.
Reshke?
Yes. Mr. Cannon, thank you for coming. The slide before, the 2006 slide, it's 2006, so it's 1 year of sample data. Do you have other years that give us a broader perspective, or we just have 2006 and hope that that's an accurate picture or it's not an anomaly?
Representative Reschke, Chair Reardon, we do not have this particular view of their higher education outcomes for Oregon students looking nationally for other years yet.
Okay.
And so it is certainly possible that 2006 was some kind of anomaly, or that there's a very positive or negative trend since 2006. And as I indicated, we believe that when the sort of state data systems are better aligned and integrated, it will be possible for us to update these numbers more regularly and answer that question.
So this is a baseline then, or a starting point?
Absolutely.
To look at that.
Yeah.
And I have a follow-up then.
Yeah.
On the following slide, you mentioned something that you didn't want to talk about, which was the idea that younger people are less educated than the general population. Is that correct?
Sure.
And so, but you also mentioned before that the recession in 08, 09, 10 drove a lot of people back to college. So I'm wondering, are we looking at the fact that the younger people being less educated than the general population because we've driven people back to the overall population back to university or two-year schools, as opposed to what it would look like in 2008? I don't know if you have that information.
Representative Reschke, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, I think that is a very plausible explanation for part of what I described. The surge in enrollment that Oregon experienced, and I have slides on this later on, during the 2008 to 2010 period in particular, was driven by adult Oregonians who were going back to school, leaving the workforce, et cetera. It is also the case, to be clear, these students who were measured, their degree outcomes were measured in 2013. They were high school graduates in 2006. Many of them were still in school, right? And so these numbers on the right-hand side, these degree completion measures, they will increase. They continue to increase age 27, 28, 29. There are a lot of students age 28, 29, 30 earning degrees. It's taking longer, right? So I think that gap over time will close. But you're absolutely right. I suspect that part of what's driven it was the recession.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The next slide just is a projection slide. It looks both ways. So the red line in the middle is 2016, and this is actually a projection of our high school graduate population, again, broken down by race, ethnicity, just to emphasize the point that Oregon and Oregon's likely higher ed population is growing increasingly diverse. This is likely comes as no surprise and represents a great opportunity for the state to capitalize on the increasing diversity of our high school graduating population. And should our graduation rates increase for these populations, we'd see even greater increases. So we certainly hope and support that being the case. The commission really has three foundational documents. One of them, the legislature established, and it was 40-40-20. The second is an equity lens that the HEC adopted in 2014. It was written originally for and by the Oregon Education Investment Board, and it is a statement of commitment around equity of outcomes in higher education, a statement of belief about the opportunity that that represents, and that helps to drive the commission's approach to budgeting and policy. So 40-40-20, the equity lens, and the commission's strategic plan. And I've provided copies of that, the most recent version of that plan. That's the second plan the commission's adopted. It covers really the 2016 to 2020 time period. And there are really six categories of strategies in the plan related to setting goals, funding, pathways, student support, affordability, and economic and community impact. And there's a fair amount of detail in the plan. I'm happy to come back to describe in more detail different portions of it. But it reflects really the commission's view of its role in helping drive in some of the greatest opportunities for helping drive improvements in higher education and workforce in Oregon. So you may be wondering, what is the heck, and how is higher education actually structured in Oregon? What am I doing here? And so the next set of slides attempts to really sort of take a step back and say, how are we organized in Oregon today, especially given the changes that have occurred over the last 6 years? So this is the sort of key, you know, put it all on a slide depiction, at least of the public higher education system. So on the very left-hand side, we've got the legislature and the governor, and it's the key state kind of entities that are involved in higher ed. The brown represent agencies. The green represent public boards or commissions. On the left-hand column, these are governor-appointed boards and commissions that are involved in education and partner with the HEC and each other in improving education in Oregon. In the middle is a description of the HEC. So we are, as I mentioned, a 14-member volunteer governor-appointed commission supported by an agency. I'm the executive director of the agency and report to the commission. We have various functions and offices within our agency, and I've listed them for those like Representative Clem, who have a lot of history with some of these offices. I want to point out that OSAC, the Office of Student Access and Completion, is an office of the HEC agency now. CCWD, which will be familiar to you as Community Colleges and Workforce Development, used to be a standalone agency, is now an office of the HEC. We have a small office focused on coordinating the public universities. We have an office that was inherited from OSAC and from part of it came from OSAC, part of it came from the Department of Ed, that's focused on our oversight responsibility for private post-secondary education in Oregon. And we have a workforce investment office that we that coordinates very closely with the Employment Department and supports the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. So we are a single state agency governed by a state commission that is responsible for all sectors of higher education, public and private, but is a coordinating agency, not a governing agency. And I'll say more about what that means in the next several slides. But to start, I'll shift to the right-hand side and note that on the public, for our public higher education system, we have 24 institutions, each of which has independent governing authorities. So 17 locally elected community college governing boards. They hire and oversee their presidents. They set their tuitions. They set their tax policies, since those are taxing jurisdictions. They adopt their local institutional budgets. So we help to coordinate them. We help to fund them. We administer programs that are very important to them, but we do not oversee them. We work in conjunction and in coordination with them. All of that is also true now for our seven public universities, which no longer belong to a single state system, but are governed by seven independent autonomous governing boards. In their case, not elected, but rather governor appointed, Senate confirmed. They cooperate in many respects with each other, including formally through a shared services enterprise that provides a bunch of shared administrative support, things like risk management and health insurance and other activities that they do together. But they are governed separately, and our relationship with them, again, is one not of oversight, but of coordination.
Could you talk at some point the flow of money?
Yes.
Through here, or is that?
So, I'll touch briefly on it now, and if there's time, come back to it later.
Okay. And then I have a question related to Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is helpful, and you know, new members here. This is important to understand the structure and how it's changed. You know, prior to this slide, we had an OUS, an Oregon University system, that had governance authority over the seven public universities. They were in charge of their budgets, helping to choose presidents, all that kind of stuff. That's all now rests at the university level. We used to have one OUS person who would come here and speak on behalf of the universities. Now they all are free to actually engage with us separately, although we have Jock here right now who has their authority, correct? So he's got the proxy today. But it's different. And then we had a community college and workforce development, again, kind of group that oversaw the colleges. That's gone away now, and workforce is now within the HEC. But again, the HEC doesn't have governance authority. They don't have to run their budgets through Ben. They have the authority to do this out in the field and so forth. So, and that was all put in place at CREDA, inspired greater strategic planning and so forth and so on. So rather than a top-down, it's a very more spread out, equally empowered system now. So it's just helpful to have that history to know why we are where we are and why we're doing things the way we are now versus how we did in the past. So.
And you and Rep. Wisnett lived through that.
Yes.
Right. He was in the front line. I was back in the officers' club.
Okay. Rep. Solman, you had a question?
Thank you, Chair Rudin. So I had a question in regards, I appreciate that explanation, and also when I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, when it's looked at workforce investments, do we have a place where we have business is actually a part of this planning process that are here as partners at the table, directing and focusing the need, because I'm looking at even at those slides before and thinking when you're providing more opportunities for students and support and showing them where the needs are in the employment world, then they can invest their dollars wisely in college and degrees, and if I'm stating that clearly enough. But
Representative Solman, Chair Rudin, there are a couple of ways in which business contributes to this sort of strategic work and some of our budget and policy decisions. One is through the engagement of employers or their representatives at the level of my commission. So it includes folks who, you know, come from the private sector and have that perspective. You mentioned our Office of Workforce Investments. It is primarily, its sort of plans and strategies are primarily overseen by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is a employer majority. I think I have that right. I think by law, a majority of the seats on that board are held by employers, and they are responsible for, or representatives of employers. They are, that board is responsible for a sort of workforce plan for the state of Oregon. And so the HECS Office of Workforce Investment is working not only against the HECS strategic plan that I'm describing, but also a specific workforce plan that the OWIB has developed. We consult on that, but that is driven by that employer majority board.
Thank you.
Chair Reardon, to your question about funding, just briefly, one of the commission's primary responsibilities is to help to bring forward a budget, as I mentioned before, a state budget for this entire system, right? So when I and my staff goes to the Ways and Means Subcommittee next month, on behalf of the governor, we'll present a recommended budget for everything that you are seeing here, a recommended state budget for everything you're seeing here. And we've done that in partnership with the institutions and spent many months sort of in development of that. Then when the state legislature determines how much to appropriate to the different categories of funding that we're responsible for, especially scholarships, community colleges, universities, then we decide, in essence, how to divvy it up. And one of our core responsibilities and authorities as a commission is to decide how to allocate the state dollars to the 17 community colleges, on what basis. So the legislature doesn't write a line for Klamath Community College and a separate line for Portland Community College. We do that on the basis of formula, using dollars that the legislature has appropriated to us for that purpose, likewise for the public universities, and frankly, likewise for scholarship programs, where we adopt rules that determine how scholarship funds that the legislature appropriates to the HEC will be divvied up among students consistent with the law.
Two questions. And it's for clarification, so you're covering both operating and capital budgets, correct?
Representative Reardon, yes, we are responsible for the state investments in institutional operating dollars and state capital budget, state investments in university capital and community college capital projects. Okay. Yes.
Do you happen to know what percentage of, say, the university budgets the state provides?
Chair Reardon, I can get you the exact figures, but it depends on the university, and it depends how you look at the total. But typically, with universities, we focus on their education and general funds, so not their athletics and housing and food, right, and other kind of auxiliaries that contribute to their overall budget. But if you focus on their educational, right, budgets, the amount of the state appropriation compared to the total ranges from 15 to 20% at the low end to closer to 50% at the high end. And the variation depends on the size of the institution. The state has far more of a share of responsibility at our smaller institutions and far less at OSU and U of O and PSU. There's a slide later on that it's not the exact answer to that question, and I'm flagging this in part because we may not get through all these slides, but it's not the exact answer to that question, but it comes close.
I'm just trying to understand the relationship between what we fund and tuition.
Correct, and yes, we'll definitely get to that.
Thank you.
So just a little more about the institutions. This is who we are at the institutional level. These are the 17 community colleges and their headcount enrollment last year, and then the 7 public universities. Pardon, if any of you are sort of sticklers for geography, this is all very rough, sort of representative. But the size of the circle does attempt to represent their relative enrollment. So this is who we're enrolling at 17 public universities, 17 community colleges and 7 public universities. We'll add in here OHSU, and then I've included the circles down below for the private institutions that we are also partly responsible for, and they enroll a significant number of Oregon students. This slide includes our vision. I won't read it, the commission's vision statement, and again, some of the key roles that we play around planning, funding, and policy. I'm going to take the next slide, which is a little bit more detailed, because I want to I do want to emphasize, notwithstanding Representative Johnson's important point, that we have a largely autonomous system of public colleges and universities on the governance point. We also have a coordinating commission with significant authorities and responsibilities. So I do want to highlight those. And so looking at the bullet point list here, we administer all state financial aid, scholarship, and many, at least of our state, sort of outreach programs to students. So the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise Program, outreach to high school students around FAFSA completion and college access. That's done by our agency, principally through the Office of Student Access and Completion in Eugene. We allocate the dollars based on formula, based on rules. So as I alluded to before, you, the legislature, appropriates the funds. We determine how they're allocated to the institutions. New programs or degrees that are proposed by boards at our public universities and colleges and some of our private institutions come to us for approval. So our commission actually votes if a university wants to start a new master's program in business, it would come to the commission. If a community college wants to start a new certificate program in welding, it would come to the commission. That was put in the law in order to try to ensure that we have a coordinated system of higher education in Oregon and that there isn't unnecessary duplication. That's the way the statute reads. We're responsible for approving the mission statements of the public universities. So, again, in the interest of coordination, the law provides that the HEC is responsible for approving the mission statements of our seven public universities. We have significant sort of regulatory authority for some of our private institutions, and these tend to be the for-profit, although there are some not-for-profit, private institutions, most of which are not regionally accredited, but they are career schools that may offer degrees or certificates, in things like cosmetology or the healthcare, certain healthcare professions. We license them. We have an office that essentially licenses them to do business in Oregon. It includes some degree-granting schools that are not, again, not-for-profit, so they're for-profit or not regionally accredited. They are required to receive the permission from our commission before they do business in Oregon, and there's a variety of sort of consumer protection law that we're responsible for administering relative to that sector.
Great question. On that, because you are responsible for the licensing part of it, do you have a stipulation on the alignment, you know, making sure that if they have a program that the students are getting a degree in, that those will align, that if they transfer to another school, that those are, am I clear but not clear?
No, sorry, Representative Solomon, Chairman, yeah, it's a really important question that's of particular consequence when one of these schools closes, as several have recently, uh-huh. where there's, a real student interest and state interest in ensuring that degrees are transfer or credits are transferable and aligned. And yes, part of our review of career schools and some of our degree-granting private institutions is to ensure that there are articulation agreements or transfer agreements with other institutions in Oregon to try to make it possible for students to transfer. That said, we're in the position of telling businesses, private businesses in Oregon, whether or not they can operate. The law gives us appropriately limited authority, right? So there's a variety of things that schools have to do. We review them and we operate them to we license them to operate in Oregon. We don't have a heavy hand on that sector. My guess, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, is that there will be bills and opportunities to talk more about our sort of regulatory role relative to the private sector. I do want to note, because when you say private higher education, particularly sitting in this spot, you think of an institution like Willamette University across the street, that institution and institutions like Linfield and Lewis and Clark and Pacific and George Fox are exempt from the sort of licensing and oversight authority that I've described that we have here for many of the for-profit schools and all of the career schools in Oregon. That's a statutory exemption that is longstanding. We coordinate still with that sector, but we do not have an oversight or regulatory responsibility for that sector.
Interesting.
The final, Mr. Chair, a couple of points here. One is data and reporting. We do collect student-level data from all of our public institutions on their enrollment and completion. In particular, their demographics. So we have a pretty robust set of data systems, and we are responsible for coordinating strategies sort of across all sectors. Just a few of what we've been up to since 2015, and this gives you a little bit more of a sense of the kind of work that we do. But as assigned by the Oregon Legislature, we convened groups that produced research, policy leadership reports, 23 of them that we have submitted to you over the last couple of years on topics of interest to policy leaders. So this was the result of bills that were passed last session that said, hey, HAC, we want to know how to do X or Y or Z, or we want to know how things are going. And so we brought the folks together to have that conversation and submit those back to you.
Do we track if anybody read those and acted on the reports?
Mr. Chair, no, we certainly don't track, but it would be interesting to know. Just to give you a few examples, a bill that was passed asking the HAC for ideas about how to improve the number or increase the number of math degrees in Oregon or students who earn math degrees. How a bill that asked us to assess the feasibility of creating a state student loan refinance program in Oregon. A bill that asked us to examine the course placement practices for community college students who test some students on entry and place them into courses. We have longstanding work, as this longtime members of this commission know, around open educational resources or sort of online textbooks, as well as credit for prior learning. We report on our progress and a whole bunch of other initiatives that we've been assigned to examine or lead. In the affordability category, we launched this fall the Oregon Promise program that's being used by nearly 7,000 students. And we, over the last really 2 years ago, and in conjunction with the legislature and a bill that you passed, we restructured the other major more significant financial aid program in the state, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, to prioritize the lowest income students. Implemented starting last year a new model for allocating funding to the public universities. One of our core decision points is how, again, to divvy up the dollars, the state dollars, and we implemented a new funding model that doesn't look just at enrollment but also looks at degree outcomes. So universities are awarded, rewarded, and incentivized for not merely enrolling students, but also supporting those students through to degree completion. It's a complex model, but we'd be happy to tell you more about it. And we are implementing the new Workforce and Innovation Opportunity Act, WIOA, the federal law that governs state programs and local programs in workforce training, and we're significantly involved with our partners in the implementation of that federal law. Finally, the blue describes just a few of the ways in which we're involved in the transition question, the K-12 to higher ed, the dual credit issue. We've adopted new standards to try to broaden the ways that high schools can partner with colleges or universities to offer credit to college credit to high school students. We've reached out to many thousands of students and improved the rates at which Oregon high school students are completing their FAFSAs, and we have supported students after the closure of their private post-secondary institutions, including, for example, ITT, where last fall, with the support of the legislature, we were able to provide a option for students who had been at ITT Tech, which closed suddenly, to transfer to PCC to complete their nursing programs, and that was an undertaking that we helped to lead. The next section of this is really goes a little bit into a little more detail around student success in Oregon higher education, student completion. So these are some of this is some data around degree and certificate earning at our various sectors for 2016, over 46,000. This data is still being updated. These numbers are still coming in, especially from some of the private institutions, but a hefty number of degrees and certificates earned at Oregon public institutions, including OHSU and the 17 colleges and 7 public universities.
Is the 5,000 listed as at the private career schools part of the 46,000?
Mr. Chair, yes. And again, private career schools, there are 201 of them in the state that we oversee and regulate. And these may be, again, we've got a great school in Ashland. I think they have an outpost in Portland, too, that's for bicycle mechanics, and they are a private career school that offers training. I think the shortest is 8 weeks. It may be as long as several months or 6 months. It offers a certificate. It comes under our jurisdiction because it is offering post-secondary training in that case, obviously, a very specific career sector. I mentioned cosmetology. We have a number of those schools that come under our regulation. As well as, the phlebotomy tech, a variety of healthcare professions, dentist assistants at schools that, again, it doesn't result in a degree, an associate's or bachelor's degree, but does result in a meaningful certificate, and that's reflected in the 5,862.
Okay, great. Thank you.
This just starts to give you a little bit of national context, and this is on enrollment. I mentioned the surge in enrollment in Oregon since in the years following during the recession, really. Between 2008 and 2015, we saw a 20% increase in enrollment in public higher education in Oregon. The national average was 8.6%. So just again to emphasize just how many new students our community colleges and public universities, especially community colleges, took in during that time period. We're now, we've leveled off and we're starting to decline in the community college sector especially, and it is the result of there being more jobs and people going back to work. This, again, sort of a point I made earlier, but increasing numbers of degrees and certificates earned by Oregonians. That's what you would expect to see given the enrollment growth. But this is pretty stark increases in certificate and degree earning by Oregonians between 2006, 10 years ago, and this year, where you see these major increases in the numbers of bachelor's, associates, and undergraduate certificates earned at Oregon public institutions.
Oh, interruption here, if I may. Do you track this, I think back one slide, by international students? So would we be able to tell if there's an impact, if we have changes in immigration policy?
Representative Reardon, we do know for our public public institutions, we do distinguish between international students and U.S. students, resident and non-resident. So yes, that the international students would be a very small percentage of the total.
Okay. Thank you.
This slide again, it sort of puts the Oregon in a national context, and you know, I just showed you this increase in certificates and degrees that we've awarded, which has risen a lot since 2006. Now again, focused on the most recent, our 2008 to 2014 time period, nearly a 37% increase in Oregon in certificate and degree awards compared with a 21% increase nationally. So the entire nation, every state in the nation, saw increases during this time period. Again, recession-driven, higher education sort of counter cyclical. It booms when the economy tanks, but Oregon saw a greater than average increase in enrollment and completion. Graduation rates. So this comes up frequently, and we're so accustomed in the K-12 setting to thinking about graduation rates. We think about it less often probably than we should with our in higher education, but our universities in particular have a long history of measuring and attending to their graduation rates. The six-year graduation rates at our Oregon public universities is at 63% for our resident students. We've shown it separately for the non-resident students. We get asked, why 6 years? Don't you get a bachelor's degree in four? This is standard national reporting that permits universities to count students who have taken longer than average. It allows them up to 1.5 times the expected amount of time. This does include students who transfer between universities. So if you started at PSU and transferred to Western and completed your degree there, you would be counted in this. 63% is not great, and a lot of efforts are being made to improve it. In the context of Oregon's funding, and we'll get to that, it's that puts a certain kind of gloss on it compared to other public institutions or public systems around the country. This is not an outlier. Oregon does not do poorly relative to other states, I believe, in the public system, but it is certainly numbers that should increase, and there's a lot of variation amongst our seven universities on this metric, from a high of close to 80 to lows that are below 50. The community college, I hesitate even to put this up. This is a highly inadequate expression of their graduation rates. It would be alarming, I think, to see 17%. But there are some really important caveats around this. This, again, is federally reported using a particular federal methodology that does not account for students who begin as part-time students, does not account for students who transfer, and it does not account for students who leave, for example, for a job. So while community colleges would be quick to acknowledge that they have students who stop out before completing, for whom they really would like to have done better, and this rate should be higher, it is also the case that this rate does not adequately capture the true success rate of our community colleges. But I thought it was important to include it. Again, it's this sort of standardized federal measure.
And this is a question that's been bothering me just for a long time, because it's, you know, I just wonder if there is another way to kind of, you know, measure when you come in the door, student, what's your goal, and did you achieve that goal? I mean, it seems like that would be a better measure of success. And so is anybody thinking about different ways to measure this? Because this discussion keeps coming up year after year.
Representative Reardon, we've had it many times at the commission as well, and it is really a data collection question, right? Sitting down with every one of those incoming college students and sort of in a standardized way establishing their goal and then tracking their progress towards it is just not an exercise that collectively we've been able to undertake. There's a sort of national survey of community college student engagement that provides a more probably robust picture of community college students' progress towards their goals. And so there's a lot more that we or the colleges could bring to help to illustrate a truer picture of success rate for students at community colleges.
But it's measure of success in the eyes of the student.
Right.
And how do we do that? So
right.
I would really like to keep working on that. I think it's really an important question. And especially as you move to the outcome-based formula for funding, it seemed like we need to know the answer to that. So.
Representative Reardon, it is certainly one of the reasons why, if the commission, and it has not shifted the way that we fund community colleges, but if the commission chose to move in the direction, or the legislature were to choose to move in the direction of funding community college on the basis of outcomes, we'd have to be really careful about what those outcomes are. Affordability, obviously a major topic of interest. This is a slide that depicts tuition at our universities for non-resident students. That's the top line, and for resident students and the recent trends. Likewise for community colleges, so you can see the increases over the last decade and a half in both sectors. We, as a state, operate several programs that help to bring down the cost of college for Oregon students. I've described them. I won't go into detail here. The Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise, which is focused on community colleges, the private scholarships that our Office of Student Access and Completion, OSAC, administers. These are actually donors who come to the state or to a community foundation, but the state administers to create greater ease of student access, and a few other smaller state-administered financial aid programs. On the Opportunity Grant specifically, this is our largest state investment in affordability directly. It is a program that's undergone a few changes over the years. It is focused on Oregon's neediest students, lowest income students, and it continues to suffer from underfunding. The red line is the number of eligible applicants. The green line is the number of students who we have served with awards. Students become eligible by completing a FAFSA and qualifying under the law and rules that the commission has adopted, which are basically income-based. And I also want to note that those 41,000 students who are receiving opportunity grants are receiving an award that's been capped at about $2,100 a year, whereas the law and the intent of the program was to meet their full need, which is typically much higher than $2,100. So this particular slide probably underestimates that funding gap.
So we're doing half as much for half as many people.
That would be, Chair Reardon, that would be a rough way of putting it. Okay. Yeah. The Oregon Promise is a very different type of program. As you know, the goal of Oregon Promise is to bring down the cost of community college tuition for qualifying students to zero or near zero. And this is a slide that we could go into in more detail in an Oregon Promise-focused presentation. In a nutshell, this shows the way that the program is funded for students at different income levels. EFC stands for Expected Family Contribution, and it's the proxy for family income or ability to pay. And students who have a $0 EFC are low-income students. Their community college tuition is funded through the Pell Grant, primarily, plus some Oregon Opportunity Grant and some Oregon Promise dollars. The red line across the middle is the average tuition at a community college. This is on a per-term basis, so you may be wondering why these numbers are as low as they are. This is just for a single term. You would multiply them by three to get the full year. But this describes that for a higher EFC student, the Oregon Promise steps in and fills that community college tuition gap. We could spend a lot of time on this particular program. I expect that we will over the course of the legislative session. This is just one of many ways to understand how the program operates. This is actually the sort of main point I wanted to make about affordability. And it's not a data slide, so you get a little bit of relief here. But affordability is not about tuition alone, okay? And so the way I like to sort of walk through this is to start by saying affordability begins with, you know, how well-resourced is this family? What is the student or family able to bring to the table? And then moving clockwise, so that's at the top. Well, what are the costs of college? That includes tuition, but it includes other costs that are, in fact, for many students, much greater than tuition. Room and board, textbooks, supplies, transportation, et cetera. That varies depending on the institution and the particular setting. That tuition plus other costs may be significantly reduced by financial aid, particularly grants and scholarships that don't have to be repaid. That may come from the state or federal or other partners. So with those first three alone, the affordability question starts to get a little more complicated because looking at tuition to assess affordability is not sufficient. You have to understand, well, what are the students' ability to pay and what financial aid is being brought to the table. I think it's really important. Our commission has really emphasized other factors as well. Does the student complete their certificate or degree? Higher education is a good value, even at a high cost, when students complete. And I didn't bring that data today. There is some fascinating new data, national data on this, that I think is important and we're still working with. But higher education continues to be an exceptional value for students who earn certificates and degrees. And guess what? That's true in every field. It matters maybe more in some than others. It is a good value. Students who do not complete and are saddled with high tuition, high debt, not enough scholarship funding, that is a significant problem. So to me, affordability cannot be decoupled from the question of whether students are succeeding. And investments in student success are also investments in affordability, even though they may not bring down tuition. Likewise, time to completion. A student who takes many more years and incurs those additional room and board, living, other costs, that plays a big factor in affordability as well. I noted, you know, the type of degree or certificate or major does affect affordability. There are degrees that are more remunerative in one's sort of lifetime earnings. And so I think it's important to take that into consideration. And then the final point is earnings after graduation. So if we really wanted to take a sort of holistic view of affordability, we would stop focusing on tuition alone and we would look at the larger picture. And that's certainly been the commission's emphasis as it's made budget and funding recommendations. Mr. Chair, I'm cognizant of your time. The last slide
now.
Here.
A quick question.
And yes.
I just wanted to comment that you will now be welcome in my office because you talked about textbook costs, which my legislative aide has spent a lot of time with many of us on. There is a program at Oregon State, which Jock's still back there, I think. Do you know much about the move towards trying to get more open source textbooks at other campuses as a partial solution for the cost of textbooks?
Representative Clem, of the House Higher Education and Workforce Committee in 2015 the legislature passed a bill that originated in this committee that assigned to the HAC the responsibility for establishing an advisory committee and operating a grant program on open educational resources. And so we've actually, as an agency, been pretty immersed in that work for the last year and a half. We have a open educational resource specialist on our team who is not only running the grant program, which has produced OERs, open educational resources, for I think 14 of the most common courses in Oregon public and colleges and universities, but is also providing support to faculty and administrators as they attempt to get those materials in the hands of students and faculty. It's a really important topic. It is driving affordability or unaffordability in some alarming ways, and OERs are one way of helping to mitigate that.
And there, I have heard discussion of a bill coming forth to continue that. So I would certainly encourage that.
Good.
Chair Reardon, I can either stop here or carry on. I am cognizant of your time. The final slides just deal with state funding. I recognize this is not a funding a Ways and Means Committee, but at some point, whether now or later, I'd be happy to provide a little bit of the funding history and context for higher ed in Oregon.
Well, we have 15 minutes left.
Oh, great.
And
I'll keep going.
But
it could get icy.
Pardon?
What?
No, I'm as former teacher, I'm kind of sensitive to my the dynamics of my classroom, and thinking that we have absorbed a tremendous amount of
just
material.
Just Brian's attention span.
And we're also cognizant of the weather, the conditions that are changing. So if it wouldn't disappoint this committee too greatly, we could assign you to homework, which would be to finish reading this online. Would that be all right?
Absolutely.
And we will get to see Mr. Cannon again during this
once or twice
during this session.
This is really bad.
If if that's okay with everybody, I'll go ahead and
for a teacher especially.
We can adjourn. No objection. Hearing no objections, I will close the informational hearing.
You might hear cheering here.
I will close the informational hearing. Hearing no objections.